It did.
Yeah, you're like, hey guys, how you doing? And Colin's like, great! Let me tell you about erotic fan fiction in my blog. And I'm like, oh, God.
Well, let's get started. I'm Jacob LaRocca. I'm
Rob Masick.
I'm Skunk.
And this is A Maker Tale. So, introduce yourself for us.
My name is Skunk. I wear many hats. Probably the fanciest hat is the Fleet Admiral founder of Skull, a bicycle chopper gang. Some people call it a nerd gang. Sometimes I do, but sometimes my...
There's no shame in that. No shame.
Some people don't like it in the gang. They say, we're a bicycle chopper gang. So that's what we are. We're a bicycle chopper gang, established 1996 of your Earth year. I teach here at the Artisan's Asylum. I teach TIG welding, Introduction to TIG Welding. I'm a sculptor. I make emotional robots, Raygun props, and rocket ship models under the name Skunkadelia. And when the sun's up, I usually am at Seven Cycles doing graphic design for them. I do all their web, print, and photography.
Cool.
And I run a gallery here at the Asylum called the Ready Room Micro Gallery.
Which is awesome, I will have to say. Awesome.
Thanks to the people who contribute. Yes.
Are you saying we have to get off our duffs and do something?
Take a hint. Yeah.
Because you're right.
Wow. There's so many people contributing to that gallery.
It's I just talked to Handsome Dan about a project that we're both really excited about.
Handsome Dan?
Dan Stern.
We're going to interview him at some point.
He is handsome, isn't he? I didn't know that was his call sign.
He is ruggedly handsome. Yeah. He's not. I can't remember his last name.
Oh, yeah.
So I just call him Handsome Dan. And the first time everyone's like, who's Handsome Dan? And then I explain him and they're like, he is handsome.
And it's got a nice alliteration to it.
So. Oh, yeah, yeah. I think it works well.
Handsome Dan.
Let's just get him in here now.
Well, he is on the list.
I think he's on a date actually right now.
Oh. So we won't interrupt him.
Yeah, I don't want to interrupt that. So, let's see. You do TIG welding. You are the Fleet Admiral Skull. Now, for me, Skull is the most interesting thing I want to hear about. I'm actually part of Skull, as you know.
Not officially yet.
Well, that is true. I
haven't earned your wings.
I apologize. I am a maggot in Skull. I am not part of Skull yet.
Yep.
My name is Rocket. So, that is the name I have picked so far. I'm allowed to change it until I'm knighted. Is that true?
Yeah, but there's a lot of paperwork involved.
Oh.
Because then we have to learn your name all over again.
That's fair. That's fair. I like Rocket, though. I already started Rocket Props, so I mean...
That's beautiful.
Staying.
Yeah. And I gave you that emblem of some... I think it was on some vacuum cleaner.
Yes.
Yeah, it said Rocket.
Was it really... It was vacuum cleaner?
I think
cleaner?
It was a vacuum
That's
cleaner.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I have to ask, how and when exactly did the idea of Skull... come about?
Well, most great ideas are stolen. I came up with, I was influenced by another chopper gang called Chunk 666, and they were out of Reed College, Portland, Oregon. And it was back when the World Wide Web loaded JPEGs very slowly. And I remember the first time I saw a tall bike, you know, you see this image load, you see this guy wearing a helmet, and then it scrolls down a little bit, and you see a superhero cape. And then you see a person and some handlebars, and it just keeps going down. And I realize there's not really a bike underneath him yet, and it just keeps going. And there's this tall bike he's riding, and the cape is unfurled and flowing. And I was like, that's going to be the first thing that I do that my brother hasn't done to show me that it's safe to do yet, because he was the daredevil, but I couldn't believe it. So I was just learning welding at the time, and I managed to scrape together a couple of cheap frames and cut them up and stick them together to make this bike called Sky King. And it was real sketchy. And I learned how to, you know, ride that, and it was terrifying. Started on the grass with like a helmet and elbow pads, and then I made it all the way up and down the bike path. And then I made a few other choppers and applied to be a chapter in Chunk 666. And since it was just me, and I just had a couple of choppers, they were like, well, I'll come back when the city's in flames and you've got a few more people, you know, following you.
When the city's in flames?
Yeah, they're kind of a post-apocalyptic
gang.
I
think the name kind of alludes to that, I guess.
Apparently, CHUNK isn't really an acronym. It just stands for the sound it makes when you put these bikes together, or when they break, or whatever.
Interesting.
And so I decided, instead of, I thought that, you know, each, this gang, it was very fascinating to me because they had kind of invented this culture that was kind of had a bicycle as the nucleus, as this modified bicycle. So it was all this kind of, let's learn to ride on the rims and make things out of garbage and not spend any money. And I thought that was really cool, but I kind of wanted to do my own thing. And for a while, I was toying around with the idea of that we were going to be, you know, like knights on horses. And I'm really glad we didn't do that, because, you know, there's not really, it's kind of a limited fantasy world. You know, well, what's a light? It's a lance? I don't know. So, we, you know, I was playing this game, this video game called Escape Velocity. It was for the Mac. And you had these spaceships, and you would travel from star system to star system. You could name your captain and your ship, and you could modify it and outfit it with different stuff. And
I think I remember that.
Yeah, it was really fun. And so I kind of based Skull Culture on that video game, where we were pilots riding ships on missions around the greater star system, the bottom, you know, Boston star system, Somerville system. Black holes were rotaries. Meteorites were glass on the road. So there was this, you know, kind of science fiction is kind of this open-ended culture. So anything we invent, we can come up with like a sci-fi term for it.
I love it. I'm still learning all of the lingo.
The jargon, lingo. Yeah. It's a lot
still
of fun.
Still learning it all.
Yeah. I yelled at, let's say, daily, if not every other day, because I come in and call somebody by their street name.
The civvy name, yeah.
And Seven's usually the one that gives me the most crap, because I'm like, hey, where's so-and-so? And she's like,
who?
You mean Half Pint? And I'm like, maybe? Do I?
Well, in Skull, if you drop a civvy name, you have to do a push-up. But you're not in Skull, so she's just giving you a hard time.
I know, and I wish I could do a push-up. Well, I was talking with someone, they're like, why do you ride with Skull? I'm like, lack of push-ups and poor memory.
I think I owe a few push-ups.
Better memory or... better memory or better push-ups.
Now, does it count if you're a maggot and you use a civvy name?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
I owe you a few push-ups.
And it's cumulative throughout your career. So if say you're riding a Skull for 3 years and you drop your fourth civilian name, you're doing four push-ups, and then the next one's five. I think I'm up to eight, because that's kind of a later rule. We kind of come up with new stuff as it goes.
Okay.
So the first, I'd say, 6 or 7 years, we didn't have that rule. I had no idea that my name would, as Skunk, would become my art career name. But when you get enough press and Skull about you doing this crazy stuff with the bikes, and then you start your art career, I kind of felt like it was necessary to stick with it. But
go with it, you know.
I might pull off the mask this year. We'll see.
I first started here,
it's not going to be that exciting.
We pay you, and they gave me this check, and I'm like, who's that? They're making a lot of money compared to everyone else. They do a ton of classes, but I don't know who it is. And then there was kind of like a hush, and everyone was like, you just can't say that name. And I'm like, but why not? You know, this person, you know, I'd like to meet them. You know, I didn't know that we even did this much. And then
I blow it all on candy.
Hey, that's the best kind. I blow all mine on tools.
Even better.
I'm like, oh, that's Skunk. And they're like, yeah. And I ran into the same problem with, like, Echo and Seven. And, you know, as I'm handing out all these checks, I'm like, who are these people? Realizing that their civvy names, you know, they get paid by their civvy name, but on their Skunk name or just, you know, Asylum name, artist name, it was hard to figure out who was what doing what.
It does seem to be a maker thing, or at least maybe it's like a, you know, a computer avatar sort of thing, because everybody, you know, if you're, say you're Mike, you know, you go on the internet and you're like, I'm Mike. It doesn't really, it doesn't, I don't
but
know,
I'm Rob
sticker.
On the internet too. Sometimes I'm Robot Rob.
But you're larger than life, and you're large in life.
I've tried to be that. I'm like, I don't need to be different, because when I was younger, I was still a giant dude with like green and orange hair, and, you know, just enjoying my days, not really caring about stuff, and people like, I didn't really care, and I still do not care what people think, and it's a lot easier that way. So just being Rob is kind of my persona.
It works for me. In Skull, you actually pick your own name. In most cultures like this, the nickname gets given to you, and you're stuck with it. But the motto of Skull is be a superhero version of yourself. And we're encouraging people in the group and outside the group to think about what that means and just take you and make it the ultimate you. So don't be like a superhero, be you, but better. And just strive to that. You never really, obviously it's a way and not a place. But I like the idea of people being able to reinvent themselves and call themselves whatever.
I just want you, but better. Just an upgrade of you, but yeah. You know, still you.
Yeah, it all came from these, there was a kind of a Rhode Island School of Design infusion where I started hanging out with some people at this this organization called Kaiju Big Battle, and they did monster fighting with like in costumes.
Oh, like
with,
Pacific Rim, but like
but with
in
real
costume?
Wrestlers, yeah, and like cardboard.
Oh my gosh.
Buildings that they would crash into.
That's
and they would,
amazing.
It's really fun.
That's yeah, amazing.
Kaiju K you know, means monster in Japanese, and then battle B A T T E L, and they do videos and stuff, and they kind of they'll
absolutely
add some,
have to look this up.
Yeah, yeah. And anyway, there was a bunch of RISD kids or people in that contingency that joined Skull, and we were talking about what Rhode Island School of Design did to an art student, and they said it was just like they just intensified their personality and made them more awesome.
Did Chris go to RISD too?
Chris,
is that what he
yeah.
said? Okay, yeah. So the last guy, the other bike builder we just interviewed,
nice,
also went to RISD. Sorry, I just made that connection.
Yeah. Oh, just a note we have to take. I have a friend that has something called Table Fights. And you make fine furniture tables with animatronics built in and fight them. We have to go find them.
Oh my gosh.
It's amazing.
That sounds
amazing.
You
get drunk and fight, like, it's really beautifully crafted furniture with weapons that come out of them, and then, like, the tables smash each other.
That's absolutely amazing. We need to find them. So, a few minutes ago, you mentioned that you have a brother. Are you... Do you only have one sibling or multiple siblings?
I've got one younger brother and one younger sister. So, my younger sister is an art teacher, and my younger brother is a carpenter. He does the wood stuff.
So there's definitely a family tradition of making things.
I guess so. Well, in our... Yeah, my brother and sister. My mom used to do, you know, like needlepoint stuff, and it was pretty intense. She has a couple of pieces that took several years to do. My dad liked... to tinker with stuff. He liked cars.
So your parents definitely encouraged that sort of thing then?
or indifferent. Or.
They put up with it.
That's the
My mom probably encouraged me a little more than my dad. My dad's like, don't touch that screwdriver. It's expensive. So when I finally move out of the house, you know, I'm 30. No, you know, 18. And I eventually moved to Alston, and I break my sister's screwdriver. Like, I strip it out because it's cheap. It's like, oh, no. I'm only making $4.25 an hour at Harold's Ice Cream. I go down to the hardware store, and I'm like, this is going to kill me. And he's like, I'll have a flathead screwdriver. He's like, what size? I'm like, what? I had no idea. Just pick me the normal one, and it was like $3. And I was like, that's it? $3? I got the whole set. I was like, that's awesome. And that was the beginning of, like, tools are not something I can't afford. You know, even on that meager budget, I was like, I'm getting a screwdriver. I'm getting two screwdrivers.
And that's at that point. That's cool. Probably like a good screwdriver for $3.
It probably was. Yeah. Well, I didn't. You know,
was it
you
Craftsman? Still have it? I mean,
I don't think so. It was like an Ace. You know, lifetime guarantee, though. I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know.
Do you still have that, or?
Oh, I gave it to my sister.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that makes sense. I remember my first tool was a set of Allen wrenches, Bondus ball drive.
Ooh.
So like
very nice.
The nicest Allen wrenches you can find.
Yeah. I spent solid like $12 on them. My first job was at a hardware store, and I don't think I brought a dime home from that place in the 3 years I worked there.
It is nice to have nice tools. It makes you want to make things. It makes you want to
make
things right.
Just bought a nice set of Bondus. They're not $12 anymore.
No. Well, I just picked up a ratchet wrench, and I can't even think of the name. It's from some German company. There's a company called Chad's Toolbox if you ever want to blow money on tools that are nice and European. And it's just, you put it in your hand and it's like somebody meant this to be in your hand.
Yeah, it's like the lightsaber.
And it's got five positions where the head goes, and it's got a dealie so you can use it straight on like a screwdriver.
Wow.
And it's just so nice.
That's pretty cool.
I love tools.
Tools are awesome.
You have a giant tool. I mean, like, how did you... So, when did you pick up TIG welding? Like, ice cream shop where they're like, hey, there's a TIG welder out back. Get to the refrigeration lines.
I wish. Well, my brother, actually, it all started when my cousin got a job at Merlin Metalworks. I was probably 1990 or so.
Merlin's another bike.
Yeah. They were actually, at the time, they were right down the street from the Artisan's Asylum in Olive Square, Smith Place. And it was they were sharing a building with another company called Fat City. And then my cousin started working there as a machinist. And then my brother got a job there. And then he was telling me all these horror stories because it was during a kind of a recession. And he would talk about layoffs and people like who got laid off in the parking lot, giving everybody mean looks in their trucks and just kind of like these really depressing stories. And then a couple of years go by. By the way, my brother's the one who got me into bicycles. When I first moved to Boston, I got rid of my car and started with that. But he said, oh, they're hiring for finishers at Merlin. And I was like, no, thanks. I just got promoted to assistant manager here at the ice cream store. I think I'll stick with that. And then I started thinking about it. I was like, what am I thinking? I got to do this. And so I applied and I got the job. And then later on, my sister started working there. But they've all moved on to less foolish endeavors.
And I've good wording.
Around. Yeah. And so over the, I think from there, I worked there for a couple of years. And then another company started with a lot of the same employees that left Merlin called Seven Cycles. And then I started there on kind of the ground floor and finished learning my welding stuff, machining, finishing, final inspection, shipping, the whole works. So I could take a bike all the way through production. But I learned welding because I was at Merlin doing the CNC operating stuff and the final machining. And the president at the time, Gwynne Jones, walked by me and said, you're artistic. You should learn how to weld. And when he said that, I was just like, oh, yeah, that would be awesome. So I practiced after work, you know, and until they kicked me out. And I did that for a few weeks. And then they thought I was showed enough potential where they were going to train me on the clock. And
so Merlin, all those bikes at that time were TIG welded frames or still brazed?
They're all titanium, all TIG welded bicycle frames. They're all stock frames. Seven is all custom stuff. And we do steel, titanium, and some combinations of filament wound carbon fiber with titanium, like lugs with aerospace grade epoxy. But I'm a metal person, as you might guess. Like, especially the titanium is really
to quote your underling, steel is real.
Steel is real. Yes, absolutely.
I heard that every day from Piranha. She'd be like, steel's real. And I'm like, but it's so heavy. Steel's real. Just having her around.
All right,
here.
Well, maybe I'll start the catchphrase, tie is fly.
Tie is fly. I like that.
Yeah. Pretty sweet material, if you can afford it.
So, this is kind of a tie-in. So, in Skull...
I get it.
I'm glad that you got it.
Oh, okay, I get it now.
In Skull, you build bikes. Members build bikes. You build bikes for a living. Now, the bike you showed me, I think it's Mjolnir, or rather, excuse me, the ship that you showed me, Mjolnir, is all titanium, right?
Correct.
It's all scraps... scrap titanium you found and you just decided to build this ship? Can you explain
something like that?
Well, no, he's right on the money, but I'm just reminiscing with the hours that I put into that ridiculous bike. We had already built the world's first titanium chopper and with a couple of scrap pieces of mountain bike frames from Merlin. And my friend Mike at work, he says, you should build a Raleigh chopper out of tie. It'd be so easy. It's all straight tubes. And I was like, yeah, that'd be great. And so I was saving stuff out of the scrap bin, and they were all like, you know, 11-inch pieces of tie. So nothing was going to be long enough to make this chopper.
Oh.
So I took a bunch of pieces and butt welded them together, filed out the welds.
You can't
smooth.
Even tell, by the way.
You can't until it breaks.
Has no, it broken? It's
not. Yes, it has. I fixed it. But that part hasn't broken. And the head tube I had wasn't long enough, so we like welded on cups on the top and the bottom. The boom tube from tandem bikes became the down tube of this bike. And So it was a really long and involved process. And I took, I made the dropouts myself. They're like track dropouts out of like, I'm thinking they're probably 3/8 inch tie plate. I used the wrong hacksaw and it took me a day.
Oh, Jiminy Crickets.
Yeah.
It sounds like Johnny Cash's song. You're out of 64, 65, 66
pretty
Chevy.
Pretty much like that. Except this was legit. I had the green light to do this. And then we tacked it up and I made my own forks to go with it. I had an old Manitou forks, you know, because they just kind of bolt onto the steer blades, and welded some dropouts and put a bottle opener on it so you could pop a beverage on after you pop a wheelie. And then these really crazy handlebars, and we built it all up and it just rode so funny. It's like
I attempted to fly it. Did not work.
You didn't like that one?
No.
It's really fast and it's super lively, but it feels like it was built for like an orangutan. It has like really long
it's got
reach
weird proportions.
And it's got a really weird handlebar set up, so you're kind of hunched over in a really weird way, but
the front wheel is,
I think it's a 16 inch front wheel and a 20 inch rear wheel. I was going to build my own stick shifter to go with it, like a little ball bearing and a spring to have it pop into the next gears and
awesome.
Have this thing infinitely adjustable. And I was like, I think I'm done with this project. But it did win. It did win Best Custom at the Lars Anderson Transportation Museum.
Oh, wow.
Which was cool. We got a hat trick in Skull for that ship. Another ship called Star Hustler, which is a tandem made from a couple of old pre-war cruisers.
Is that still here?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's at my fort because it's so big. But it's the glow-in-the-dark. It's
the one
with the glow-in-the-dark stars.
Yeah, okay. I've seen
it's
that one.
It's a midnight blue tandem.
Is that the one you and Red Squirrel haul around on?
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah. It's coded in 800 glow-in-the-dark stars, or maybe less now because, you know, we go
pretty fast. Stored some on the ground.
Yeah. And the third one was Catastrophe, which was it would build as the meanest bicycle ever made. World's meanest bike, that's what it said. But I think that when you show up with your chopper gang and it's like a voting scenario, we kind of have a little bit of an edge.
It does seem unfair.
Kind of sandbagged it. Yeah.
I mean, keep doing it. Like, if you get away with it, go for it.
Well, this was a long time ago, back when I cared about such things. But now you don't have anything to prove. Yeah.
So I imagine it's been pretty cool for you to see Skull evolve and people come through and leave. And now when we go out on a mission, everybody in Somerville knows Skull as an entity.
Yeah, when we give tours, it's, you know those guys on Saturday night that high-five each other on big, silly bikes? They're like, oh, yeah, those guys.
Yeah.
So everyone in Somerville, Cambridge, everywhere knows.
We're very high profile. So every time we go out, everyone sees it.
Funk music helps.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're
big presence.
Not causing trouble is, I guess, the best way to, like, you know, the good mischief, not the bad mischief.
We're the good guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We had a noise complaint once from a neighbor on Bow Street, and apparently we were waking up her dog, and the whole neighborhood had a lot of dogs in it, and sometimes we'd do a loop-de-loop. We like to ride around round things for some reason, rotaries and squares and things, and so sometimes we'd do a second pass, and it was, you know, there'd be stupid 30 in the morning, and these dogs would go crazy. So I'm coming in to teach a class, and the desky at the front says, oh, the cops are here looking for you. He said he'd come back later. And I was like, oh, man. And so he shows up, and the first thing he says, first of all, I love the bikes. And so I knew it was going to be fine. But he was talking about this woman who had a dog and stuff. And I said, well, let's just not ride down that street anymore, because it was such a short street.
Yeah.
It's easy to avoid. So that's off limits to us. And if we do, we do silent running. So anybody who hears us and doesn't want to hear us, you can contact us through the normal channels of your video blog and pass the complaint on to me.
Yeah, or just not do that, and if a bunch of people are having a good time, suck it up. So that's more...
We'll be gone in a minute.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll be gone in a minute. Another thing that we do is if we have a mechanical or we have to stop for any reason in a residential area, we have silent running. So if the radio turns off, no music, then it's silent running, which means whispers only. We've been doing, this is our 18th season completed. We're in the off season now, and we've made a lot of mistakes in the early days just because, you know, noise curfew stops at 10 doesn't mean that you really want to make noise from 7 o'clock until 10 o'clock in your neighborhood every Saturday night. So we posted sentries out there with Nerf bats and reminded people that it was silent running.
That's awesome.
And the only way to really regulate it is to say whispers only, because you can talk softly and a little louder and a little louder and a little louder, and it's hard to draw the line where, okay, now you're too loud. So we're very strict about it. It was funny because we'd be getting ready to launch out of my basement, and you'd have some inebriated people walking by, and they'd be like, "What is this?" Really loud. Like, "We're a bicycle chopper gang." "Wow, that's awesome!" You know, like, we call that sonic cover. Yeah. Or if somebody's having a party next door, that's another.
So now, when I came here, you guys were in the corner, and I forced you to move up front by the front door.
Oh yes,
at one point.
That was such a terrible thing to do.
we're a nomadic tribe now.
It was amazing because when you guys moved in here the first time, or when you moved that. I think the preparation and everything, all in 2.5 hours door to door to move everything in the skull area, which easily had to be 2,000 to 3,000 pounds of just stuff.
Yeah. We have a very excellent and pragmatic XO, Hackworth. He gets the job done. So I complain and he fixes. And or I mention something offhand and it gets fixed now. It's the level of autonomy in skull is incredible. There's a lot of ownership individually in the gang. People feel like it's their gang. And when they have that sense of ownership, they really take responsibility.
His coordinating event
is just insane. Yeah.
How do you build that autonomy and kind of build that structure? Like, was there any place where you're moving down the line and you looked at two options and one of them you took and you're like, you know what, we got to go the other direction because this is actually... making the game less awesome and not more awesome?
That's a really complicated question. I wouldn't say that I've ever tried nothing that comes to mind. I tried something and then said, that's not working, let's go back to what we're doing. Because if you're trying something new, that usually is a sign that it needs to change. So we could try it, and if it doesn't work in certain ways, then we'll try something else or we'll modify that thing. But I think we're always evolving and moving forward. As far as ownership in the group goes, I'd say the biggest single thing that helped with that kind of feeling of ownership is having it move out of my basement and into the Artisan's Asylum. Because when it was in my basement, it was my basement. And if you wanted to use the bathroom, you had to ask me for a key. You know, so nothing happened without me being there. I had to attend every MRC, which is maintenance, repair, and construction, and fly every mission, and, you know, there's burnout involved. But it all kind of makes sense because, believe it or not, I've read an article in Harvard Business Review, and it talked about the 5 stages of growth in a business. In a lot of ways, I think of Skull as a business, but instead of money, we deal in fun, and people have said that before. But
that's awesome.
But the first one is kind of the entrepreneurship and the charismatic leader that gets everybody motivated, and you have kind of direct, you know, access to each individual. But each time that you have that stage happen, it's because of that certain thing, and then that certain thing, in this case, entrepreneur leader, winds up becoming the thing hindering you from the next stage. So the next stage would be something like, you know, you would have to have some delegation and some more autonomy. And then the leader stepped back. And then the third stage is kind of middle management, where you assemble small teams with team leaders. Again, each one kind of leads to the next. But I do think about Skull a lot in sort of a business sense or a sort of a culture sense, but most of the time it's kind of running on its own at this point, which is a really proud thing, you know, when that happens, where you're, you know, when the leader has very little to do because you're just getting in people's way.
Well, some of the personal development things that I've seen, because you have some maggots that have come in, and, you know, just in the nicest way, hangers-ons, like they're just showing up because you guys are cool and you're cool older people, building bikes, having a good time. And I've watched in the 2 years that I've been here, a lot of these maggots develop personally. And it may be just that they're younger and they're aging, but I think being in that environment and being allowed, like watching them being allowed the freedom to make mistakes, but the support when they do make those mistakes of how can we fix this, and, you know, a non-judging group that I've seen a lot of personal improvement with people. Was that at all an intention, or is that something that's just a nice thing that happened that you had no idea was going to happen?
Well, I feel like I learned with everybody else in the early days. You know, I just wanted to ride crazy bikes around. I didn't really care about much else. And since I was the only one doing that sort of thing, I kind of created this smokescreen on the internet of like every time I rode, every ship I built, and every person that rode with us got like became a gang member and a mission and a ship. And we documented everything from day one. And then it became this tradition. So in a sense, I'm learning just as much as anybody else. I'm not sure if that answers the question or not, but so I wouldn't say it was intentional per se, but you kind of keep your eyes open. I like to trust people right away, and then if it goes sour, you kind of rein them in a bit, and that's worked very well for us, you know, for the most part. I'd say not just for the most part, I'd say it worked out very well for us.
Most of Skull is like the best members we have.
Ah.
And your organization, so I think we'll try and grab pictures of it if we remember. We may just put this up and you have to go look at the Skull website. But they have, in the Artisan Asylum, a 40,000 square foot facility. I've probably described it in different ways on different episodes. But we have, I don't know, how much space do you guys have now? Like 500 square feet, something like that?
I thought it was closer to 7, but...
Could be 700.
Hackworth could tell you right down to the square foot.
I know, Hackworth can tell me. I run this place, I don't know anything.
Yeah.
But when you go in, you look, and there's a wall of tools, and everything's labeled, all the where the tools need to be. The tools are painted, so we know the black and yellow, all the black and yellow tools I find floating around the asylum need to get back to the skull
space. Get corralled back, yep.
Because things just kind of wander on their own. It's amazing. Tools have legs. I did not know that. But the tools here, they walk.
You don't even have to pay for it. They just do it on their own. We learned a lot from Broadway Bicycle School about tool boards and ship storage. I learned a lot through 7 from being a process improvement person, learning about Kanbans and Kaizen and Poka Yoke and all that kind of stuff. definitely helped us a lot in systems management and signage. Just putting the brooms right next to the coat rack is like so important to me that, you know, because on the way out, you see that broom, you know, you got to clean up a bit. And if you don't see the broom, you're like, I'll get it next time, you know. So just little things like that can make a huge difference. Our motto at the fort is leave the fort in slightly better shape than if you hadn't been there. That usually takes
motto.
Care of it. Yeah.
Cool.
Now you do art.
Yeah, I was just about to ask. So, that's your cool. Art organization is Skunkadelia, correct?
Yes.
So, how did Skunkadelia come to be?
Well, I was a 2D artist in high school and college. I did a lot of stuff with charcoal and pastels. Never had much luck with a brush. I actually got accepted to Rhode Island School of Design, but I didn't have the cash. But I wound up going to the University of Maine at Augusta and the University of Maine at Orono. And at UMA, we had a sculpture department, and they had this really rusty, nasty small pile of steel in the back. And they had a welder there, maybe an arc welder. And I looked at that stuff, and I was just like, I have absolutely no interest in piecing together these non-objective rusty things that just clutter someone's yard, and I just don't understand it, like why anyone would care. But then when I worked at Merlin and at 7, the idea of making stuff, especially the bikes, was really exciting and appealing. I think we had better scrap piles.
that does make a difference.
Yeah, really, the materials are everything. But the Skunkadelia stuff started when I had a birthday party to go to for my friend Moose, and again, a gang member.
Also the owner of our Middle Bay TIG welder.
That's right. Yeah, Moose.
Go Moose.
He had a birthday, and like as usual, I'm kind of a late night person, so by the time I got out of work, I was running late for the party, and there was no way I was going to make him a card in time or buy. I wanted to get him something, you know. And I thought, well, I'll just make him something. And I come looking around the scrap bins at 7, and I found a big hunk of bike chain. And I said, well, I'll just make something out of this. And I made him a moose. And it was probably about 6 or 7 inches tall. Had lots of little antlers on it from the little lynx. And everyone was like, oh, that's so neat. You should make these and sell them. And I said, I don't have time for that. But the more I thought about it, the more I really wanted to do that kind of stuff. And I remember the guy who taught me how to weld, Tim, he's like, oh, yeah, we used to make skull rings and all kinds of crazy stuff. But, you know, been there, done that. And I remember saying, well, I haven't done it. And I want to do it. And so I just got started doing more and more of that stuff. The first thing I came up with was a dragonfly I made with reamer blades and a spark plug. It was pretty kind of primitive. And but I showed it to my friend, another gang member, Sparky. And he said, oh, yeah, I see those all over the place. That'll never sell. So he's really encouraging.
Is Sparky Spark or is Sparky not Spark?
Sparky now lives in the left coast.
Okay,
with
so
Tank
not
Girl.
Spark.
Oh, you had a Tank Girl.
Yeah, we had
point.
A Tank Girl. And nice. She lived up to that name like you would not believe.
That's yeah. awesome.
She's now a Unitarian minister. But Sparky...
Sounds appropriate.
Yeah. Sparky, well, he says, that'll never sell. And so I call it Sparky Fly to spite him. And the Sparky Fly is still available today, but it's evolved a little bit now. Instead,
has it sold? Do you sell them?
Yeah, I sell them. Although I kind of like the Sparky Bee a little bit more because they're a little cuter. But
it's the best part about selling out, cashing the check.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm making millions off of the Sparky Flies. But my real passion is the little robot creatures. Yeah, those are my favorites.
So that was the first when you did the Ready Room Gallery. You did the robots and ray guns as your first show, and I know you had done some others because I've seen you rolling around with the trailer. When was the first time where you were like, I have enough stuff to put and make people show up to?
Well, let's see. I started doing Somerville Open Studios. That was the first one. Very inspired by other artists. I did the Somerville Open Studios tour, which is, I'm sure it was several hundred artists at the time, opened their doors and their studios to all of Somerville. Now I think it's over 400. But I started seeing all this amazing art in Somerville, and I thought, wow, I want to do that too. And I never went to Somerville Open Studios again because I had it in my house. So, you just crank some stuff out and you have a show.
You're going to be set up real good this year for Somerville Open Studios here.
Well, I'm having a hard time choosing whether I want to have it at my place or here, but I think I might try to do both because I have some big pieces in my place. I've got a, you know...
I still want to see Hathor. I've never seen him.
Oh!
I don't think I've ever seen him... Sorry.
Yeah. She's an Egyptian goddess.
My apologies.
She's going to be offended.
She might be.
She could tear you apart.
Yeah,
tear
I was
going to
say,
apart.
Egyptian goddess her. Might be kind of terrifying. She's got big blades on her back. Excuse
yes.
me.
Doing yeah. it again. A lot of people mistake her for a male. But
anyways, so you've got some big pieces, like you said. You've got one that's made out of electrical disconnect boxes.
Yes, poor Mobot. He was one of the early ones. In the early days when I started after the moose and maybe a year or two afterwards, I started thinking I wanted to make some big, giant robots. In fact, the Mobot was inspired by a Far Side cartoon, which was this shop kid was, you know, there's a guy writing on his desk and this kid in shop class says he's got this giant killer robot behind him with like big fangs and claws. And he said, hey, Bonehead, my project's ready for grade. And hey, I'm talking to you, Squid Brain. And he's like, hasn't looked up yet, but this is like 9-foot robot behind this little kid. Like, could obviously
I
tear
love
him
Far
apart.
Side.
And it's like, I want to make one of those. And before I knew how to weld, I was thinking about galvanized steel and a bunch of copper rivets I was going to put together. Oh. I still have the rivets, but I can't imagine the work that would be involved in something like that. But one
Not
day
that
there
much
was a...
Until once you can do it. The problem is that learning curve, like TIG welding for you now is probably pretty simple.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Imagine thinking about TIG welding before you could TIG weld. You're like, it's just magical that those two pieces of metal are connected.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so Mobot was actually made out of these electrical breaker boxes that were being gotten rid of in front of this house in Watertown. Somebody tipped me off to. I called a friend. She had a minivan. We picked them up, and we got something like 40 electrical boxes.
40?
Something ridiculous like that. It was a huge pile up front, and they're really old. They're probably from the 60s. And And I made a few smaller robots with those little pieces as just their torso, with like a bullet lamp for a head. And then I decided I wasn't going to run out of these things anytime soon, so maybe I should just kind of get it all done together. And so I borrowed this bicycle trailer from Broadway Bikes, and it really wasn't designed to carry much. And the hitch was just a piece of a tire that someone cut, and like a bolt that went through a piece of conduit that was attached to the back. And I loaded up. This is definitely the scariest bike ride of my life. Oh, wait, there was another one after that. But this one was just awful. I was riding down Summer Hill, and the tire snapped, and this conduit, I was riding on my cruiser with the one coaster brake down this hill, and the conduit just went right up in between my legs. And I'm really glad my thigh wasn't in the way, because it was like a freight train, you know. And it just starts pushing me down the hill, and I have to like fix this thing. But, oh, it was terrifying. And every time I took a turn, I thought I was going to just lose it. And so I went from Somerville to Watertown, which is about five light years, as they say, skull.
I've put a lot of thought into that, because like I've had the vehicle equivalent of that happen to me, where I lose brakes on the trailer and brakes on the truck.
Oh,
and I only have one set of rear brakes on the truck working. I'm like, I'm going 80, and there's a brick wall in front of me.
Yeah.
And, you know, trying to wrestle those things so you don't kill anyone.
Oh, man. I still have dreams about that stuff.
Well, surge brakes on trailers, and this is an idea that I've thought about. Do you understand what a surge brake is?
No.
So a surge brake, it takes forward motion and compresses a hydraulic cylinder.
Ah.
So the idea is that compression of the hydraulic cylinder would give you a relation compression onto disc brakes on the trailer itself. So that way there'd be a circuit. So when pressure is not needed and you accelerate, it pulls the pressure off the brakes. But when you brake, instead of having a connection where you'd have a second brake pedal or brake handle for the trailer, then the weight of the trailer going forward, trying to push against your front brake stopping, then provides braking force to the rear wheels.
That's neat. That's a cool. What's the brake called again?
It's called a surge brake.
Surge brake. I like that. So it's using the inertia to activate the brake.
Yeah, and they do that a lot on trailers for like U-Haul and rental trailers,
so
because
you don't have to hook
don't. Yeah, they don't want to hook anything up. And honestly, if you ever see a U-Haul driving on the road, you should get out of the way, because anyone driving a U-Haul is probably liable to kill you.
Yeah.
I want to hear about the more scary bike ride.
Oh, well.
You promise me crazy stories. So.
I have a lot. It's going to be hard to pick them all. I've always liked those Dutch cargo bikes or the front loader, where you have a regular bicycle and then you have this kind of flat bed in front of it with a little tiny 20-inch wheel. And
there's like a
rod
that goes up.
Mm-hmm. So a friend of mine, Death Trap, he's in Jamaica Plain System, and he's like, I really want to get rid of this cargo bike. Everyone started calling it Bob Barker because the price was right. It was free. And I got to say, I got ripped off. this thing was amazing. I think Death Trap rode it to Three Speed's house. And then I went to ride it from Three Speed's house to my house.
Three Speed intended to get rid of this?
He was getting it to me.
Okay, because I'm like, Three Speed doesn't throw anything out of it. Three Speed got rid of it. That must
he didn't
be
want
bad.
It. Yeah, he didn't want it. And so I rode my 7 over, which is, you know, 19-pound, you know, featherweight, and I put it in the front. I realized I couldn't get the wheels off because I had some special locking thing. But anyway, just riding it from Three Speeds to my place, which is probably 3/4 mile, was really, I think I walked half of it. And then I was going to fix it up because, like, the brakes were, everything was wrong. And then we brought it here to the asylum. And I live 1 mile from here, up a big hill, down a big hill. And I got it fixed up as best I could. And then I was riding it back. And if you've ever experienced what's called high-speed wobble, it's essentially if you look down from the back at the two tires from behind the bicycle, it would kind of look like a sawhorse, where the wheels are not making contact on the ground in the same plane that it's moving. So what happens is if you get up above, say, 10 miles an hour or so, especially on something this big, the whole thing just starts to shake like an earthquake. And I was just going down this little hill, and I thought I was going to just get dumped off this thing. It was shaking so hard. And I wasn't even home. I'm like, I'm throwing this thing out. The thing weighed 80 pounds.
You got it from it somebody even... named Death Trap. I feel like that should have been
he does
a
good
warning.
Work. Normally, this thing was just so out of alignment. And it weighed a lot. So for a cargo bike to weigh that much, it just wasn't worth it. So we stripped all the parts and chucked it out, you know.
So this bike you're talking about weighed 80 pounds. USB Cloudbuster version 2, am I right?
Well, it's always, you know, version 1.5.1.2.2, which is today's
bike
date.
That you ride on on most missions.
Typically, yeah.
That weighs how many pounds?
I don't know what it weighs now. It weighs less than it used to because I took the mast off, but it used to weigh 200. So I'm guessing it weighs 170 now.
So can you describe this bike ship for?
Well, it's kind of cross a bicycle with an elephant and a garbage truck, and that's pretty much what it looks like. It's kind of a
and a disco ball.
Double tall bike, cruiser frames, a tandem on the bottom, cruiser on the top. Paint it black, put big huge bars on it, and then put a big sound system with a car battery at the bottom and a rotating disco ball that's illuminated. That spins around in the front. We call it the disco bobulator. It used to be the disco Death Star, which was a telescoping disco ball. But I've crashed that thing into low bridges and trees so many times. I'm just 5 years or so was plenty amount of time.
I think I've seen 23 working on that in a road at some point.
Yeah, at the end of a couple of seasons ago, there was a pilot, Tyrion, and he really wanted to try Cloudbuster. And I said, well, now's the time since it was a mega mission. It was the last ride of the season. And so if you're going to dump it, you know, let's
give
have all off season is the way to go. And of course he did. He bought me a new one though. He bought me a new disco ball and helped me fix it. So everything was dandy.
Oh, so that was why you got the new disco ball? Or?
Oh, it's been several. The first disco ball was actually glass. It had a styrofoam inside. And that was telescoping. And I set that up for Project Mum, which is this party under McGrath Highway.
I've heard of that. They don't do it anymore, right?
They do. It's a proximity because they're not doing it there anymore. But actually, another Skull Pilot, YT, took the reins from the Somerville Arts Council and has been doing it. I think this year will be the third year if she does it again. It's super cool. But they had a disco-themed and space-themed the first one for Project Mum. And the theme, the logo they had was a disco ball with like Saturn's rings around it. And I was just like, I got to make this thing. Because we were talking about it forever. And so finally I put it together. But it was the bouncing back and forth of the mast really shakes apart the styrofoam on the inside. And then if you crash it, this glass ball smashes into the pavement and there's broken glass everywhere and it's just a mess. But the cool thing was I had these two halogen bulbs on it, so it would really illuminate. And just, I love the idea of having a really big bike, but having it so it has a presence that's like several lanes wide. It would illuminate the houses on the sides and the under the trees.
That's
and it would
so
all
awesome.
Swirl as you were riding on this tall bike. So it was kind of it almost disorienting and euphoric when you rode down the street with this thing. And from a distance, I remember seeing, there was a couple of pilots who could ride it besides me. And I remember Piwagon going away and he kind of hit the crest of the hill. And after he hit the crest of the hill, he'd see the sparkly orb in the sky. And you had no idea. Like if I saw it, I'd say, I have no idea what that is. And I like the idea of being extremely visually confusing at a distance.
That's awesome.
And so a lot of ships at Skull now have LEDs and stuff that make us look like we're flying around on top of starfish and things like that.
Yeah. LED technology in the past 5 years has come leaps and bounds.
Yeah. And battery technology, which was huge for us. The first...
let's talk about a warp core failure.
Which one?
The one where I think you were in the middle of class and I'm like... Skunk.
Oh, I remember that, yeah. What? It was like something just completely melted?
I think it was on charge. It might have been on Cloudbuster.
Yeah.
But like it was on charge and it just ignited. There was a short or something and just flames billowing out of it. And I'm like, well, that's not good. It was like a brand new pack too, I think.
Yeah, that's my luck. Well, when you experiment the way we do and we test things as hard as we do, things go wrong. Catastrophe was the ship I had before Cloudbuster, and I put 14,000 miles on that ship.
Wow.
on official. Well, not that was a commuter thing too, but it would catch on fire more often than the Millennium Falcon. One year, a friend of mine gave me a little tiny fire extinguisher to strap to the C tube as a joke. Well, maybe it wasn't a joke. I don't know.
Did you ever have to use it?
No. The more it caught on fire, the more we tried to make it not catch on fire. But Cloudbuster's much better. It only caught on the fire that once. And I'd forgotten about that. But yeah, we tend to really test the stuff we build. You know, people will build something and say, that's going to be good. And you're like, if it can't survive a drunken orangutan, it's not going to survive Skull. That's the threshold that we have.
Yeah. It's an awesome philosophy to live by.
So, yeah, the early ships, all the USB ships, are all, you know, been broken and repaired so many times. And every time we fix something, we fix it so it never breaks there again, hopefully. And I'd have to say that that's been the case. Usually when things fail, they fail where the
new
manufacturer puts something together. Where we chop it, it seems to be space-worthy, yeah.
You have a parrot, correct?
Yeah. His name's Nemo. Nobody.
How did Nemo come into your possession? Did you just go to the pet store and say, I want a parrot?
I was inspired by Irene Pepperberg when I saw her on 3-2-1 Contact with that amazing parrot, Alex. And he could do all kinds
show.
Of stuff. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was great. And I was like 6 at the time. And I was
Rob's dancing.
I really want a bird like that. And then I think I was 30 years old, and I saw him at the pet shop, and he was very shy and sitting on top of his cage with sitting on one foot with his kind of hand opening and closing and kind of staring at you, trying to make sense of you. And I went home, and I was married at the time, and I said to my wife, I can't stop thinking about Elmo. That was his name. She's like, me neither. We go back and meet him and asked a bunch of questions to the lady who was working there. It was at Petco, believe it or not. And we wound up getting him.
At any point during this discussion, did they say, this thing might live for 80 years?
They lived to be like something like 60 in captivity or so.
Wow.
I knew that coming onto it. He's a lifelong companion. Really cool, smart bird.
Does he say anything?
Oh, yeah. His newest thing that he likes to see, he's trying to say ribbit. So he kind of goes, this, it doesn't, I didn't know what he was saying at
There's
first.
There's porosity in this weld?
Well, now he says, this catchphrase that we used at work that was kind of funny whenever we leave, you know, like office humor, you kind of develop your own culture and stuff. And one of my friends, Carl, used to, when he left, he would go, well, try it again tomorrow. Just like that. And now my bird goes, well, he even does that. Well, round tomorrow. Sometimes he says it before I even wake up. So he's in his cage. He's covered up. And you hear, well, try it again tomorrow. And you're like, yeah, we haven't done anything.
Do you bring him to work?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I can't. No. But he comes out of his cage. And he'll, I put him in a travel cage and put him out on the porch and stuff. And he chills out with me and the cat. But he says goodbye when I leave, and he says hello when I show up, and he says I love you and all kinds of cool stuff. He does all the car alarms in the neighborhood. He does backing up trucks. He does all the dogs from far away and up close. He does a bunch of things.
That's
dog
really
telephone
cool, actually.
Calls. Yeah, he hears hello. Okay. Bye. Beep. He does the whole thing. It's just like, it's hilarious. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So where, like, you went through this whole progression, you know, filer, TIG welder, graphic designer, and now you're pushing
Ice cream scooper.
Oh, ice cream scooper before that. Was there something before ice cream scooper?
Supermarket cashier. Those were the dark days. Oh, my God. Third shift. Burlington, Vermont. I thought I was going to die.
Burlington, Vermont.
Oh, it was the worst.
Do you ever go to Market Basket and look at them and, like, think of your youth
with disdain? Market Basket seems pretty cool. Like, everybody there seems like they're actually kind of happy to be there. Grand Union wasn't like that, especially at the time. It was very corporate and very stifling to a creative mind. I couldn't believe it. When I finally moved out, I was in Vermont, and I was moving to Boston, and the the manager of the store said, "Is there anything I could do to keep you from leaving?" And I looked at him, and I was just thinking, even if you offered me your job, I would not.
No,
I was like, "There's nothing you can do." Oh, I wish he had said that before, like a big raise. I don't know.
At least he tried, right?
He tried at the end. Yeah. Oh my God, it was the worst.
So, you have Skunkadelia right now. You're working for Seven, doing graphic design.
Yep.
Anything in mind for future?
No.
That's different?
No. Actually, I want to know, how did you decide that you were going to teach people to TIG weld?
Well, I think, you know, that's a good question. I'm not entirely sure how that all came about. I mean, I think it was suggested. I think maybe Guy suggested I start up a class. And it sounded like a lot of fun. I'd never taught before. And so I figured I'd give it a shot. And it was really fulfilling. When I learned at TIG Weld, I learned on thin wall titanium at Merlin.
The easiest possible material.
Oh yeah, it was really hard to see. It was sticky. It was really finicky. It wanted to contaminate at the slightest provocation. And
did you back purge all that stuff?
Yeah, it all had to be back purged. When you're doing test pieces, you don't have to. But I remember the struggle, and it took me longer than most people to learn how to do it, and it was so humbling and humiliating. I would just try again and again. I was like, I want this so bad. I'm going to just do my best. And I'd make a test piece, and it would just slowly go downhill as I get around to the second side of it. I'm like, the next test piece is going to be perfect. But it would never work out that way. And eventually, after about a year, I finally felt comfortable. And so when I teach now, I recognize that struggle. Not only can I empathize with the person learning this stuff, that it's really hard to see and the tolerances are incredibly tight, but I also remember what I finally figured out to get out of that situation and some helpful hints. So I think that in the struggling of the slow learning curve, it actually worked out really well, and I was able to become a pretty effective teacher. When I finally have a student, get it, they'll look at you like, I got it, and it just feels so great. And any teacher could probably tell you that relate to that feeling of living vicariously through your students' triumphs. Yeah.
Well, yeah, you can be successful at the thing you've done over and over and over again for the first time.
Yeah. And it's really fulfilling to get people to stick things together permanently with a little lightning bolt.
I was bringing up Sidekick as a kind of intern, apprentice. I don't know exactly what you would call her, but...
Yeah, I guess she went with Sidekick. She started as an intern, but then I was like, what about Sidekick? And she was like, oh, she loved that. So she was a student, and after the class, she said she wanted to continue learning and asked if she could apprentice. And I really didn't think it was going to work out. I didn't really know of, projects that I could give her that would make it worthwhile and fulfilling for her. But she was eager to take on just about anything. So, we started her just taking apart bicycle hubs to make the robots and then occasional welding stuff. And then she took on more and more as the intern happened, evolved. And I think she wound up doing it for about a year and a half, maybe 2 years before she used those skills to add to a resume to get a job at a sign making place at DCL. And she said she misses it. So she built the Ready Room Gallery cage that kind of holds all the art and then the shelves underneath that hold the ammunition boxes and 4 gallon pails of metal that are hidden behind curtains. So you go into the 50 foot space and there's curtains like from shoulder height down. And then above that's like this pristine white, shelves with
lamps. We'll get some good
lamps.
Pictures of it.
Yeah, all right.
If that's okay with you,
absolutely.
Of course.
Yeah. Pictures would help a lot with what I talk about, because you're trying to describe these things that may or may not, translate.
So it looks like our time's almost up, but if you could give one piece of advice to somebody who's looking to get into metalwork, what would it be?
I'd say get your hands dirty right away. obviously taking classes here or anywhere where you live is a great start. I never went to shop class. I went to art class. But I think that, you know, use the tools and make mistakes. I think you can do a lot with a hacksaw and a TIG welder or even some nuts and bolts, you know, and a drill. You can get pretty far. Yeah.
Cool.
And ask a lot of questions. Ask questions and make mistakes.
I like it. So if you could tell our listeners your information for like your website and all that.
Yes. Well, I'd say skull.org is probably the most fascinating website. It's huge. Data overload.
S-C-U-L.
Yes. S-C-U-L.org.
Now, did you actually tell them what that stands for?
Yes. Skull stands for bad attitude. That's right. Skunkadelia is my art and personal life. And then 7cycles.com is the wonderful bicycles that I make with my crew, my coworkers. And readyroomgallery.com is the gallery space. And I think that's all of them.
Cool. Do we have any shows coming up?
I have nothing planned at the moment, but the Ready Room Gallery is always ready for visitors, and we always have something going on there, whether it's something as silly as a string fort or something full-blown as an Elves in the Mind set. There'll always be something interesting there. I currently have a show at the Nave Gallery Annex, the sketchbook show. There's a group show there, so you can look at my diary because I don't do sketches of my work. And that's all I got going on right now. It's January is a slow time.
Cool. It's great talking to you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks.
This is Jacob LaRocca.
Rob Masick.
Skunk.
And this is a Maker Tale.
Beep, boop, 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 deep.